Navy Athletics, and your source for federal news now. This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Welcome to Tech Talk Radio.
The mic's over there, Doc.
We're in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. I'm Dr. Richard Schertz.
It's the little things, and I'm
That's
Jim Russ.
Right. I forgot I had to have a microphone in front
of me. Well, you know, this is a virtual classroom of the airwaves.
I forget
that there are microphones sometimes.
What I'd like is surround mics, so I don't actually have to have a mic in front of me. I can just speak, and there are...
Any one of those little headset mics so you can walk around.
Directional mics that just track me.
You ever seen the movie Talk Radio? Where Eric Bogosian is this crazy talk show host, and he just walks. He's got this headset mic. He walks around the studio, and he rants and waves his arms. That's what you need.
That's what I need, exactly. Well, now I'm back in the saddle. I've got the microphone going on.
The appropriate broadcaster gear going.
So
yes.
I'm ready to go.
Good.
Well, this week I've been playing with my... I ended up getting those Philips LED light bulbs.
Oh, you did?
That I can control with my iPhone. So I'll talk about that. I had so much fun with it. I control my TV with my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
So I control the lighting and the TV with my iPhone.
You and I need to talk because these are things I need to do.
But yesterday we had a party and I was supposed to help, you know, get ready for the party. I'm running around programming these stinking light bulbs and getting it. I said, "Well, Marianne, I'm getting ready for the party. Don't worry, I have to get these light bulbs going." She says, "Well, the light bulbs really weren't on the list. We had regular light bulbs that worked just fine."
Oh my!
So I had to set the router. You know, you hook it into the Wi-Fi system. Then you got to connect the lights to the. Anyway, I'll talk about that.
I think you should.
It was quite a bit of fun. But you
like them, right?
I enjoy them. There's no return on investment because they're so expensive. So you get them because you like the mood that you can get out of them rather than the fact that they're highly efficient.
It'll take you 20 years to save the
money,
right?
Because a high efficiency light bulb that costs you $59 is not going to really pay for itself back in the next 50 years probably. so it's really not why you would buy them. That's right.
It's just pure fun.
Well, we'll look at a couple of technology items today that were relating to the election.
Mm-hmm.
One of them, there was a statistician that actually has used very powerful algorithms, predictive algorithms, in order to predict politics. And he was really quite accurate in his predictions. And he applied the techniques that he used for predicting baseball scores.
Sabermetrics or whatever they call it.
I don't know.
We'll figure.
It's Nate Silver is the guy's name. So he applied those same predictive techniques to politics, and it's working quite well. It's like the next generation of statistics,
mm-hmm.
and we'll talk about the big failure of the Romney Get Out the Vote application.
Huh.
He had a huge IT application they were keeping under wraps, so it was never beta tested. So on the day of the election, it was a big fail.
Wow.
And many think this is sort of the behind-the-scenes reason that he was unable to get out the vote in some of these close states. So we'll talk about the technology behind that and the bad practices that that they experience. That's kind of a technology twist on the election. Today we're going to feature in Profiles in IT Donald Knuth. He is actually a father of the analysis of algorithms, and this was suggested by one of our Tech Talk listeners as a Profile in IT suggestion.
Okay.
Yeah, so it was a very good suggestion. He's made quite a bit of progress there. And China is blocking Google again, as we would, you know, as they periodically do. And I think I'll have a time to get to the new cyber war rules of engagement. What the U.S. is actually now is going on the offensive with cyber warfare. We had been on the defensive, now we're going on the offensive. And so the question is, what are the rules? I mean, what does it mean to invade somebody? What does it mean if we know the rules of conventional warfare. What are the rules of cyber warfare? So we'll talk about the new rules of engagement. And whether you can draft people or whether you can draft companies to be part of it, whether you can have things residing on the servers and on company servers without giving them a choice of whether it's on there. This all gets back to constitutional interpretation as it relates to IT and the rights of government. It's an interesting twist. And, of course, it was a huge, huge mailbag.
Of course.
So now it is time for...
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Yeah. We got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. Schertz, attached is a screenshot of a particular mall in Maryland. Now, how to report, what I need to find out from you is how I can find more recent data. The Google Street View... is 3 years old and out of date. Is there anything else available via the internet or mobile app that would inform me of the current tenants in the strip mall location in Rockville? Most appreciated. Listen every Saturday from 9 to 10. I'm hooked. Lauren. Well, Lauren, the Street View, of course, Google is trying to photograph the world and every street in the world, so they've got these vehicles that go around on it. I don't know that they really update Street View that frequently, because once they run a street and they upload it, they have so many other streets to go that they don't really cycle back and
world.
Do it. Yeah, they've got an entire world. So Street View, 3 years out of date, that's about when they started it. I don't think you can count on them updating that anytime soon. Now, if you want to use satellite photos, since those are taken very frequently, Those are updated at least once a year, and sometimes more than once a year, because I was noticing on my, I always like to look at my house. So we built
from space,
so we put a deck on, and I could see how long it would take before the deck would show up in the satellite photos. then we built a sidewalk, and I could see how long it took for the sidewalk to show up. And in both cases, it showed up within 6 months.
So, does the dog ever show up in the backyard?
No, okay. There's no dog in the backyard. Mm-hmm. And so the satellite photos about once every 6 months. Now there is information that you can bore down. You could do a Google search. And you could put in the name of the mall. What I would do, because probably the companies there in that mall, they have a website. And so if you would put the name of the mall and the general address, not the specific street number, you would probably come up with a listing of all of the companies whose websites have that address on it. So you just do it a straight Google search. It's probably your best way to do it. There is actually information many times Google will actually show who the tenant of a building is if they've registered their name. So sometimes there will be the name from the satellite view. There will be the name of the company in the satellite view. That happens occasionally. Like if you go to the Stratford University buildings, it shows that Stratford University is in that building. Now, we're the biggest tenant, so
sure,
we're the only tenant that it shows. But you can sometimes get that. But I don't think you're going to wait for any kind of update of Street View. And there's no other Street View out there. Google's the only company that's deciding to photograph the world and post it to the web free of charge.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody else is doing that. But great question, Lauren. I'll keep thinking about that, see if I can give you a better answer. But that's about all I've got right now. We got an email from Al in Georgia. He must be a podcast listener. And I was just down in Atlanta. We're looking for a new location down in Atlanta, looking at some buildings down there. Dear Doc, I have an old IP phone. That's an internet protocol phone at home. Well, it can't be too old if it's an IP phone, but it's probably a few years old. And it does not have Keep Nat Alive. You know, that sounds like a chant.
It does.
Some Nat. I wonder who Nat is. Well, Nat is really network. Nat is network address. I forget now. It'll come to me.
Network address something.
Translation. Network address translation. Boy, I had a little brain burp there. network address translation. Nat. And that's what that. And so Nat, let me have an aside.
Yes, you need. You're stuck. Yes.
Let me have an aside before I even finish the letter. When you've got a router for your home network, you've got an external IP address that's given to you by the internet service provider. And that's the address. That's your address on the internet, and it's basically. It's basically 12 digits. It's long, and that particular address. Then you only have one address, but suppose you've got like five computers on your network, so you've got an internal network. And then your local internal router assigns internal IP addresses to all your computers. So now whenever you want to talk to the internet, your internal IP address goes into the router, and it translates it so that it shows up as an external IP address as the source IP when you're talking to it, and it assigns a port number to keep these things straight. And so it's called network address translation, and it allows the internal addresses to use one external address to talk to the internet. Okay, and the issue is the connection, the network address translation connection. You want to keep it alive so that the router doesn't forget about you. Mm-hmm. Okay, it seems like my router's NAT blocks ports. My router's network address translation blocks ports, and that is true. It's, you know, these routers are firewalls, and they are designed to block ports. Now, the phone might ring, but no voice can be heard either way, and I was wondering if putting my phone in the DMZ, demilitarized zone, can eliminate the problem, keep all the ports open forever. I know that I may have security issues, but as much as it's just a phone, I'm not too worried about that. I really don't care. Love the show, Al. Well, Al, this is the what happens if you got an IP phone and somebody's calling you. You've got an incoming phone call that comes into your router, and it has to forward that now to your phone. And normally, they have to have a certain port number that the voice is carried over. Now, when your phone sets up its initial connection, sets up its initial NAT connection, it informs the router which ports to leave open. And so when an incoming call comes in, that port's open, and it's forwarded directly to the phone. But then if the phone doesn't talk to the router for a while, that NAT connection, network address translation connection, is dropped off and the port closes. So that's why the phones have this keep NAT alive going. They keep pinging the router to keep the network address translation connection going. So your phone does not have a NAT keep NAT alive function. So then your port closes and incoming calls don't make it to your phone. Now the DMZ, what the DMZ does, it basically, you set up your router so that you have a particular fixed internal IP address, and you tell the router, hey, I don't want to filter anything. I just want to let everything that comes in from the outside world unfiltered go to that IP address, that internal IP address. So then essentially there's no firewall, there's no port filtering, there's no protection. Everything just comes right on through. And they call any devices that are in that unprotected space, they call them, they're in the demilitarized zone, the DMZ. So now you see, if you put your phone and set it up in the DMZ so that the router will actually connect to it directly and not filter any ports, the phone's not protected. But the good news is you don't have to keep the ports open through this keep NAT alive thing. So that's actually quite a good solution. And the phone's probably not people might try to hack the phone, but there's nothing in the phone, mm-hmm. really. So I think that's really a great, a very good idea. And so you can easily go into your router and you configure it, and you can go in and you configure the DMZ. You have to tell your router you wanted a fixed IP address. So you'll set your, so you'll set your phone up to have a fixed IP address so it doesn't get an IP address from the router. Each time it boots up, it has a fixed IP address. You tell the router that this fixed IP address has been taken, and so you take it out of the range of addresses that it gives out when it's giving out temporary IP addresses. And then you set up the DMZ section to point everything to that particular IP address, and it'll work. It's a great solution. I think I would try that myself. We got an email from Anthony. Dear Tech Talk, I'm running Windows 7 Service Pack 1 Home Edition on an Acer Aspire laptop. When I stream video, it starts okay, but then the video will freeze. I'm unable to use the mouse, the keyboard. The only way I can recover is to power down by removing the battery and rebooting. Help. Thanks, Anthony in Texas. Well, when this happens, Anthony, the problem is probably with the video driver, because you're running streaming videos. Probably the video driver is like it's not synchronized correctly with the incoming signal. So I'd recommend you make certain you have the most recent video drivers for your computer. Chances are you've got integrated video on your motherboard. Since it's an Acer machine, they tend to be, you know, the lower cost, totally integrated machines. So I'm thinking that Acer is going to have the updated video driver. So I'd go to the Acer website and go to support and then look for any updates. You'll prompt and see if they have any driver updates on the Acer website, and make certain that you want to know the model number of your laptop, because there are going to be different video systems on different motherboards, so you want to download the correct video driver. So with that information, I'd definitely go there and update your video. And it's possible that it's a hardware issue, but more than likely it's this video driver issue. We got an email from Alex. Dear Tech Talk, when does my router assign my machine an IP address? As soon as Windows 7 gets to the login screen, or is it done on power on? It's not, I don't have a static IP address. It just decides the next available one when it's not in use. Thanks, Alex. Well, this kind of gets back to the same. It's the reason I picked this particular letter today. This kind of gets back to that same issue. The routers assign dynamically internal IP addresses using a protocol called Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, DHCP. So the router set up as a DHCP server, and it serves out IP addresses. So when you configure DHCP on your router, there's a range of addresses that it can give out. And when a device connects with it, that device will ask for an internal IP address, and the DHCP server will give it one. And so typically, that request is done as soon as your network card makes connection with the wireless system. So that would be right after the boot up sequence. So you go through the whole boot up sequence, and then it loads the Ethernet driver or the wireless driver. And once that's loaded, and once that particular network tries to make a connection with the router, the first thing it does when it detects a signal, it says, hey, give me an IP address, and it makes a DHCP request through the network, and then it gets its IP address. So it's right after boot up. It's certainly before you would formally log on to the network. But that was a great question, and it's probably fun to go in and try to figure this out. If you can log on to your router, and then you can look around. The routers typically always have the same internal IP address. It's 192.168.1.1, or it's 192.168.0.1. Those are the two internal IP addresses that they typically assign to the router. So you just put in that IP address, and it'll bring up a browser screen, and then you log into your router with the username and password that you've given it. I hope you've given it a password. Otherwise, your neighbors can log into your router and lock you out.
And we have talked about that ad infinitum on this program.
We have talked about that a lot. I got an email from Ron. Dear Tech Talk, I have an old IBM ThinkPad running XP. Can I install Ubuntu Linux on my Windows XP operating system? Is there any harm to the software? Thanks, Ron. Well, Ron, I like your thinking. I did the same. I had an old laptop that was like sluggish because, you know, it was seeing the end of its useful life. And I decided to put Linux on it. Linux is a great option for old machines because Linux is not a resource hog. And so you can take an underpowered machine and run Linux quite well. And you can download the software from Ubuntu. You can just go to ubuntu.com, U-B-U-N-T-U. This is an aside for those that would like to do it. You can go download that. You'll download actually a disk image. and it'll be a disk image file. Then you have to go get a program that will allow you to burn a disk image to a CD. And you can, and there are a number of those. There's a number of sharewares, free software programs for doing that. And then you burn that program that you down, you burn the file that you download to the CD. Then you have a bootable CD. You just boot off the CD, and it will go through a whole installation process and install Ubuntu. Now the problem that you'll probably encounter, and this is what I encountered, is that when they distribute open source software like Ubuntu, they only want to distribute open source device drivers. And many times the open source device drivers are not available or they're not written very well. And there are probably proprietary or non-open source device drivers for Ubuntu from all the different device manufacturers, but they're unwilling to conform to open source requirements to share the code. So they won't release their driver as an open source driver, and Ubuntu won't put it on the distribution disk because it's not open source. So then what you have to do is it will show you a list of all the missing drivers. This is one of the weaknesses of the whole open source movement. And you'll have to go around and collect the proprietary device drivers that are missing. Now, I would suggest that you go to the Ubuntu forum, put in the computer that you've got, and I'm thinking there are lots of people on the forum that are going to give you advice on where to get those drivers, because that is always the big issue. Now, here's the thing, though. If you take and install Ubuntu on the machine from that install disk, it's going to wipe out your XP operating system completely. It's just gone. So you're not going to be able to go back to it, because it'll have just disappeared. So if you have a choice, you could actually save an image of that hard drive so that if you decide you don't like Ubuntu, you could actually restore that image and you'd have your computer back the way it is. Now, what I would recommend is that you install VMware and create a virtual machine. So you could install, boot it up in XP, install VMware, and then VMware has a mechanism to then transfer the XP operating system you booted up in into VMware to run it as a virtual machine, and then you've got one virtual machine there. Then you could install Ubuntu as a second virtual machine, and then every time you boot up, you could decide, hey, am I going to boot up on my XP machine or on my Ubuntu machine? So then you could install Ubuntu without even disrupting your XP operating system. Now, this, of course, assumes that you've got enough hard drive space to support both systems. This also has a second advantage for you. If you're kind of IT looking for jobs, not only are you going to learn something about open source software, you'll also learn something about virtualization, which are two hot topics in the IT world. Certainly would be worth learning about if you want to have a career in IT. We got an email from Mark in Richmond. Dear Tech Talk, what is Microsoft doing with Messenger? Are they going to make me use Skype? I'm worried. Thanks, Mark in Richmond. Well, Microsoft recently announced that Microsoft Messenger instant messaging would be migrated to Skype. Now, of course, they purchased Skype in 2011 for a lot of money, so they want to use it. So they are actually, all the voice over IP products that they had, they're basically getting out of, and they're using Skype as the central glue for it. So, in fact, Messenger is going away and Skype is replacing it. Now, at the same time, Microsoft announced that you can log into Skype using your Microsoft account. So they have actually synchronized those account usernames and passwords. So you can use your Microsoft account to log into Skype. So they're bringing the authentication piece together. And when you do that, when you log into Skype using your Microsoft username and password, you'll find all your Messenger contacts have been transferred there for you automatically. So you don't have to transfer them. Microsoft transfers them for you automatically in the background. Now, so which is actually very, very convenient. Now, in order to use your Microsoft account, you log into Skype, you need to download the latest version. The latest version has got all these integration things. And then when you install the latest Skype, Microsoft Messenger will be removed from your system. This actually makes sense because you can do everything with Skype that you do with Messenger and more. Now, as you step through the installation phase of Skype, they're going to ask you, like, would you like to make Bing your search engine? Would you like to have the Bing bar on your drive? So I just uncheck all of these things. Yeah. Don't take all of the all the stuff that they try to sell. Just be very careful. Each time you press next, look at what you're saying and uncheck all those things so you don't get a bunch of Microsoft garbage drop down on you. And then after you're done, you can log in to Skype use your Microsoft account. Now, if you already have a Skype account, as I do, the next step allows you to merge the two, and it's very easy. And it just says what it is. You log in to Skype with your Messenger account, and it says the next step allows you to merge the two. You click on. It says I already have a Skype account, and you'll be asked to log into that account. After which, you'll get this information: your accounts are about to be merged, and that's it. Skype's replaced Messenger, but you've saved all of your data from both Messenger as well as Skype in one place. So it actually works out pretty well. We got an email from John in Fairfax. Dear Doc and Jim, I've got an HP laptop running Windows Vista, Home Edition. When I try to turn it on, I get a single beep and then a long beep, and the machine will only turn off after I remove the battery pack. Any advice would be greatly appreciated. Thanks, John. Well, John, this is clearly a hardware problem. Unfortunately, it's not really something that you can probably fix yourself, because it's difficult to open up laptops and fix hardware. You'll probably have to get some technical help on this. But the beep codes are kind of interesting. You can go to computerhome.com/beep.htm, and it lists all the common beep codes. And so they'll be like beep, 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 different beep codes. And the reason they've got these different beeps is that the monitor doesn't show up, and when the machine is going through what they call the power on self test, it's called the post sequence. So it's going through and doing a self test. It tests the RAM, it tests the video, it tests all the different components on the motherboard. If one of those components fails, the post test has a beep sequence. So then, by listening to the beeps, you can tell which component failed at the time the machine locked up. And so the most common failure would be, say, if your memory is corrupted, you would fail the post test. Well, that's fairly easy. You can swap out memory. But if, say, it's something wrong with your integrated video, that would be hard to fix unless you replace the motherboard. But so you can listen to the beeps, and then you can go and go to computerhope.com/beep.html, and you can look up all the beep sequences for the different power on self tests. Each one of the CPUs has a different boot up sequence, and they've got different beep codes, so you can look them up and see what it actually means. So you'll learn a little bit about hardware there, but it's a great question, but the prognosis doesn't sound very good.
That's too bad.
Okay.
All right.
Great question. Well, listen, we love all your emails. Mm-hmm. Email us at techtalk@stratford.edu.
Now, not only are you the instructor of this class over the airwaves,
yes,
but you're a multitasker. What else are you doing?
Yes,
over there?
I'm also monitoring the Tech Talk Facebook page. You go to facebook.com. and /TechTalkOnline, and I will be right there monitoring the page. You can make comments during the show, and we'll cover those comments during the show.
Keyword is monitor. You're like this ever-present hall monitor.
That's right.
Yes.
Any funny business happens on that Facebook page, I know about it.
Oh, and he knows where you live. This is Tech Talk. We live on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by. More Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tysons Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. And now it is time for
Profiles in IT.
Yes, today we're going to feature Donald Irvin Knuth. Donald Irvin Knuth is a computer scientist and the author of the multi-volume work, The Art of Computer Programming. Knuth has been called the father of the analysis of algorithms. Knuth is also the creator of Tech's computer typesetting system. It's actually a WYSIWYG type of authoring software that allows you to embed equations very, very conveniently into what you are producing. Knuth was born on January 10th, 1938 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, where his father owned a small printing business and taught bookkeeping. Knuth was actually quite bright as he was growing up. Like they had a contest, for instance, that you had they had a contest. You had to come up with so many words out of like a sequence of letters. And Knuth came up with 4,500 words. The judges' master list only had 2,500 words, so he actually had more more words than was on the master list, and so he won the prize. He was actually a very clever guy from quite young. He loved music. And when he went to Case Institute of Technology, he had to say, physics or music? Physics or music? And he chose physics over music, reluctantly, because he did love music. Now, while studying physics at Case, Knuth was introduced to the IBM 650, was one of the first mainframes that was out there. And after reading the computer's manual, Knuth decided to rewrite the assembly and compiler code for the machine. Because he believed he could do it better.
Of course.
And he did. He rewrote it. Turns out he just had a knack for analyzing things and for programming. In 1958, Knuth constructed a program based on the value of each player. This was a basketball player that could help his school's basketball team win the league. And it was kind of a predictive algorithm. And it was actually extremely effective at helping the team manage their personnel. This particular program that he wrote, the computer program based on statistics, was actually picked up by the press because it was so novel. It was published in Newsweek, and it was even covered by Walter Cronkite on the CBS Evening News. And this was while he was still in college. Knuth was one of the founding editors while he was still in college on the Engineering and Science Review. He then switched from physics to mathematics.
Ah.
And in 1960, he received his Bachelor of Science and Master of Science degrees simultaneously. He actually finished his bachelor's, and the faculty were so impressed with his work that they gave him a master's degree because they said, this guy is exceptional. In 1963, he earned a PhD in mathematics from Caltech. And then he began working at Caltech as an associate professor, and that's when he started writing his seminal work, The Art of Computer Programming. This work was originally planned to be a single book, and then he expanded the plan to be a 6 and then a 7-volume series, quite an extensive series on computer programming. Now, computer science was new, and many papers that had been written around that time, Knuth felt, were simply wrong. So one of the motivations for writing The Art of Computer Programming was to tell the story about programming well so that we could have a generation of well-trained programmers who created good code. In 1968, just before he published the first volume, Knuth accepted a job working on classified problems for the National Security Agency, obviously some sort of security code things, which is highly mathematical. Knuth soon left that position and went to Stanford to join the faculty. I think he had some sort of disagreement over the war. This was, you know, during the Vietnam War era. After producing the third volume of the series in 1976, So you see, he started writing them in 63, and he finished the third volume in 76. That was 13 years for three volumes. He took out time to work on, because he was frustrated, because his volumes had too many equations. It was hard to do the layout of the equations. And he said there were really no good typesetting methods for mathematical treatises that were available electronically. And so he decided to write his own word processor language that could actually handle equations, and it was TEX, T-E-X. And he also included the Metafont tools, which actually were fonts that could be embedded in the mathematics. And TEX, this is the dominant software that's used by science, by the scientific community, for writing these technical papers. And so he just needed a better word processor, so he created one after his third volume. The guy's quite a prolific programmer. Now, he retired early in teaching from Stanford because he realized that it would take him another 20 years of full-time work to complete The Art of Programming. See, he'd finished three volumes. He had four more to go. Three volumes took 13 years. So he thought four volumes are going to take 20 years. And if I don't retire and work full-time on writing my volumes, I'm never going to finish The Art of Programming. And he feels that this treatise, The Art of Programming, is his life's work and the most significant thing that he's going to do. So he wants to make certain he gets it done. So in his retirement, while he's writing The Art of Programming, he spends about 2 hours a day in the library, about half an hour at the swimming pool, and the rest of the time at home reading and writing. That's what he does every day. He's been sort of a recluse. He doesn't really get out much because he's just focused on writing this book. He does like to play the piano and the organ in the music room of his house.
Huh.
As of 2012, the first three volumes and part one of volume four have been published. Knuth gives informal lectures a few times a year at Stanford, which he calls Computer Musings. He likes to do that because actually he misses the interaction with the students. He misses teaching, really. So he goes back to give these lectures informally. He's also a visiting professor at Oxford University whenever he wants to get back. And the guy has a great sense of humor. Like, he used to pay a finder's fee if anybody would find a typographical error in his books, and he would give a finder's fee of $2.56. And he would give a check. Now, the reason he did that is because 256 pennies is exactly equal to one hexadecimal dollar. And it turns out that these checks for $2.56 have become collector's items. So if anybody found a mistake in his book and they received the check, they don't cash it, they frame it.
Right.
Because it's quite a compliment that you found an error in one of Donald Knuth's books. In 1971, Knuth was recipient of the first ACM Grace Murray Hopper Award. That's really quite an achievement.
The
first one,
too.
He's also received various other awards, including the Turing Award, the National Medal of Science, the John von Neumann Award, and the Kyoto Prize. So this is a man who has devoted himself to teaching and to advancing the art of programming. And he's really not chasing money. He's chasing knowledge. He's chasing communication. He's in it for all the right reasons. So there you go. Donald Erwin Knuth, the author of the multi-volume work, The Art of Computer Programming, and the father of the analysis of algorithms.
Oh, I hope you were paying attention, because every week we do this thing where there's a quiz and you can win some stuff. We're going to do that in just a couple minutes here on Tech Talk. So stay tuned for the pop quiz on Tech Talk Radio here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. We'll be right back.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
According According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, five of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the Internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for Washington's most popular and longest-running radio game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's your host and star of our show. No, it's not Gene Rayburn. It's not Alex Trebek. It's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
And now it's time where the metal hits the pedal. Where the pedal hits the metal.
Or the rubber hits the road.
Where the rubber hits the road. When you're at class, you've got to demonstrate your ability to retain key facts and key knowledge.
You need another
sidebar. I'm going to have to get my analogies a little
bit straight.
You were up
way late last night.
I think I got to go to analogy class.
I think you actually do.
I was up very late last night. That is actually the truth.
I figured that.
So here's the thing. Earlier in the show, we're talking about Donald Irwin Knuth.
And not that much earlier either.
That's right, not that much. He was, of course, the author of The Art of Computer Programming. Now, every time somebody finds an error in one of the books that he writes, he sends them a finder's fee. What is the dollar amount of that finder's fee? And if you get the right answer, you'll get two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room or the Karim Dining Room.
Well, we're pressed on time, so there's really only one way for you to get that answer to us, and that is to call us on the phone, dialing these 10 digits in the correct order. If you're calling from west of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it's 877-936-9333. East of Falls Church, Virginia, 877-936-9333. The wild card line is 877-936-9333.
Yes, and if you're calling us from Siberia, you can reach us by Skype by going to Tech Talk Radio 1, and that will be forwarded directly to the studio,
free
of charge.
Do they have the interweb in Siberia?
Oh, I'm certain they do.
Okay.
Some of those classified sites up there. You see, there are like some scientists up there secretly working on things.
Gotcha.
And I'm certain that they're tuned in to Tech Talk, listening live on the show.
Getting valuable information.
Getting valuable information as part of their espionage activity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about the fun I had last night with my Philips Hue light bulbs.
Should I keep my finger on the dump button?
I had really a nice time because last week these lights had just been released for sale November 30th, and they're only sold at the Apple store. I talked about them last week. They looked interesting, so I just couldn't resist going down and buying them. So I bought a controller. I bought the starter kit. It's a controller. It's got the controller device along with three light bulbs for $200. $199.
That makes a big difference.
$199. And then I actually had six light bulbs in the room, so then I bought three additional light bulbs at $59 each. So for a mere $399 or thereabouts, I got six light bulbs and a controller, and I could have put regular light bulbs in there probably for $3.
Probably right, yes.
So it's merely a factor of 125 times more expensive,
but exponentially much more in fun.
But here's the thing,
right.
It's a lot more fun. So what I did, it's the controller. It's a small round disc, about 4 inches in diameter and about 3/4 inch thick. And you plug the Ethernet cable from that disc into the back of the router, so it connects to your Wi-Fi router by Ethernet cable. Then you, you know, then you plug it into the wall so it's powered. Okay, once you do that, you take and put your lights, you put your six lights into the, I put my six lights into the system, and then I turned them on. Now, the three lights that came in the starter pack were already paired with my router.
Okay.
So I then I had to control the router. So to control the router, I had to go to the Apple App Store and download the Philips Hue application. That's H-U-E, Hue as in Hue color.
Right.
And so I downloaded the application, and then I searched for a device on the Wi-Fi net. It found the device, and then it said go. Then once it found the device, it said press the connect button. So I pressed the connect button and made a connection to my device. And then I could see three light bulbs because only three light bulbs were attached to the controller. So then I went into the application. I said, find more light bulbs. Mm-hmm. So it found three more light bulbs. So then I was set. I had all six light bulbs. So then what I could do, I could go in and they have various ways to adjust the color. So I could open up one of these devices and I could set the bulbs all for blue or all for red, and so I could just
what kind of a party were you having?
I could just move the mouse all around, and it could be blue, red. Yeah, I let actually the guests suggest what color they liked.
Ooh,
and it turns out, you know, they've got one option, you know, if you want to be energized and it's very bright. You've got another option if you want to be relaxed, and it's a little dimmer and sort of a little off color.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you
want to,
and if you want to read, it's kind of a little yellowish tinge.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's actually, so you can adjust them for reading, for relaxation, for energy, or for party. You know, party. I mean, so I was running blue lights.
Does like
actually
a disco ball drop down out of one of them for party?
Well, I'm waiting for the application that actually links the lights to music. So the entire house becomes a disco. All of the light bulbs are like vibrating to music.
I want to party with you.
Now I like these, actually these six light bulbs in the room, so I'm going to get five more light bulbs for the sunroom. So now what happens is that how do you know which light to turn on? Well, so you basically label the light bulbs by what room they're in.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you have, say, an application, then I might have TV room reading. I click that application. It turns on all the light bulbs in that group. So once I open up a setting, I tell it which light bulbs I want to have join the group. Because it would be a pain in the neck if every time you turn on the light, you had to individually turn on each light bulb.
Sure.
So you just have a group, and so I'll have the sunroom group, and I'll have the TV room group. Now, the other interesting thing you can do is that once you get these different groups, you can set them so that they'll turn on and off on a schedule. So you could put 50 light bulbs in your house if you wanted to spend $5,000.
On light bulbs.
On light bulbs. And you could have the kitchen lights turn on, and then the sunroom lights turn on, then a bedroom light turn on. And you could make it look like there's somebody in the house all on a schedule. Or you could have the lights in your bedroom wake you up, sort of gradually come up, kind of like a
sunrise.
Yeah. So you could do a lot of different things with it.
Let me ask you, what did Marianne think of this fabulous this display of consumerism?
Well,
did she like?
Well, I told her that it cost about as much as half an outfit.
Ah,
so I put it in perspective.
Yes, got it.
I put it. It's about half an outfit. She said, "Okay, that doesn't seem bad." So, but what she didn't like was the fact that I decided to buy them and install them the hour before the guests arrived for the party.
God, Doc, why do you do these things?
And I had all of these things I was supposed to do, straighten this picture,
yeah,
move this down, move that down. And I was tinkering around with my router and setting up my light bulb groups.
I'm sure that went over real big.
Yeah, that went over real. Now, but the reason I really like this iPhone control, is also I can use my iPad to control it,
mm-hmm,
is that I control my TV with my iPhone because I have the Logitech Harmony Link, which hooks to my Wi-Fi network, and then it converts the Wi-Fi request to IR, and then the IR pulses turn on all my devices. So now I can sit in the TV room, and I can turn on the TV, change the channel, and I can adjust the lights all with my iPhone.
That's pretty wild.
And I actually don't even have to, you know, get up to do that. And I never lose the remote because I always have my phone. But I also I can control everything from my iPad. So we in the house we have two iPads and two iPhones. So we really have four control devices for anything. So now even when I'm upstairs, if somebody's downstairs watching TV, I can start bringing the lights up and down.
Turn the TV.
I can turn
off,
the TV
on the channel.
It can be like Poltergeist, and the TV turns on,
terror.
Turns off. The lights are changing color.
Good grief.
And I'm not even around. In fact, I could even if I would want. I could set up my lights where I could control them remotely, where I could basically log into a portal so I could be in India and I could log into the portal at my house and I could control all the lights. And so you can imagine the poltergeist possibilities.
Dr. Richard Church, making friends worldwide.
That's right. And now wait until they get, and these all follow the Zigbee standard, the wireless Zigbee standard. Mm-hmm. And so they're great. They're coming out eventually with Zigbee standard locks for your house, all kinds of home appliances. So you'll ultimately be able to control all kinds of things in your house using that same Zigbee wireless standard. That's pretty much all you wanted to know about. When I party,
if Doc knows how to party,
I know how to party.
Unbelievable. Okay, all right. We've had somebody waiting. We've had several people waiting patiently on the line. Let's go to. I see a new name here in the back of the class. He's kind of hiding. We're going to call on Matt from Alexandria, Virginia. Matt, good morning and welcome. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great.
Great. Doc, ask the question.
Okay. Earlier in the show, I talked about Donald Irwin Knuth, of course, the author of The Art of Programming. What is the award that he gives if somebody finds an error in his book? How much money does he give them?
He gives them $2.56.
That is correct.
That is correct.
That, of course, would be one hexadecimal dollar.
Exactly.
And so, excellent. And so now you get two tickets to fine dining, the Escoffier Dining Room, the Carême Dining Room. Just stay on the line and give your name and address and email address to Professor Andrew, and he will take all that data.
That's
and we'll
right.
get back
he
to
is,
you.
He is, of course, our adjunct professor for keeping things straight around here.
That's
I,
right.
I changed that and fudged it a little bit. Hey, Matt, while we got you, how long have you been listening to the show?
Actually, just this morning.
Great. How did you find us?
I was looking for the football game a few weeks back, and I turned the radio on. It was on your channel, and I'm a computer science attorney. So I said, this is great. I'll listen.
Did you ever think that stupid Navy game would bring us
That's
listeners?
Great. That is fantastic.
Not stupid, but
that is great.
We thought that,
we love Navy
we
football.
We love Navy football. Matt, we thought that game kind of messed us up a little bit, but we appreciate you listening. Thanks a lot. Hang on and stay with us. You're listening to Tech Talk here on Federal News Radio on 1500 AM, 820 AM, 1077 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. More after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Tech Talk Radio. We are in the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University talking technology. Let's talk about Orca, the big
Not
data,
the whale.
The big data application that Romney's team had developed under wraps to help them with get out the vote. They felt this would be the big edge in Tuesday's election. Orca, of course, named after the killer whale, but this whale, it's not a killer whale, this whale is a beached whale. It didn't work out. Now, many things went wrong with the Romney campaign, but one of the biggest failures was the campaign's big data application for getting the vote out called ORCA. Now, Political summarized all of the issues, and I'm highlighting this because it's sort of a classic way, a list of ways you can make a mistake when you're launching a big application. First of all, the Romney campaign kept it secret, which meant they didn't even beta test it before it was rolled out on election
day. That's like 101, isn't it?
And it was so secret, they didn't train people on it. So you're launching a big app that's not beta tested without training. Now, that meant the people it was designed for, the thousands of volunteers across the country, didn't have a chance to learn how to use it before it was launched. And ORCA kept crashing throughout the day because they hadn't checked whether the servers could handle the load. Now, the system was designed to identify likely Romney voters who had not yet voted on election day and then get them to vote. But it continually crashed, and the people didn't know how to use it. So it's, you know, if you're launching a big app, you really don't do it this way. Now, the workers on the ground didn't know what doors to knock on or what efforts to make, to who to target, who had not turned out. They didn't know what they should do. And so the campaign officials also generally didn't know which precincts to send autocalls to try to get a better turnout in an area. They really were running blind. They had no data. There's no more damning an inside account than that by John Ekdahl at Ace of Spades. Now, he was a volunteer, and he's actually a systems developer, an application developer, and he was worried about the system from the beginning because he said, you know, this system's never been stress tested. I don't know how they can expect it to work. In addition, it was billed as an app. So all the volunteers kept trying to go to their Android phone, their iPhone phone to download the Romney app. Well, actually, it wasn't even an app. It was just a website which was optimized for a mobile device. So they had to go to a web address.
Mm-hmm.
But the communication was so bad that they didn't even know how to get it. And the end result was that 30,000 of the most active and fired-up volunteers who could have really made an impact in the election were wandering around confused and frustrated. They could have been doing a lot of things to help, but they didn't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
They could have driven people to the polls. They could have done phone banking. They could have walked door to door. Now, you know, people that have looked at this said, you know, Romney lost by fairly small margins in Florida, Virginia, Ohio, and Colorado. If this had worked, many think it could have closed the gap and made all the difference in the world. So that is how not to deploy a big data app in politics. Or anywhere.
Anything, right.
But it's interesting to sort of look at the behind-the-scenes technology that gets into this.
You got about a minute.
Got about a minute. Google is blocked in China. As usual, you know, China wants Google to censor things, and they don't want to censor it. So now they've blocked everything. Google's own transparency report, which is designed to detect and publicize service disruptions, shows a sharp drop in traffic from China all across Google's products. Now, it turns out that the Communist Party's 18th National Congress in China has just started. This happens every 10 years. And so the fact that it's blocked out during this Congress doesn't look like a coincidence. So people wonder whether it's going to be up and running after the Congress is over or not. Google is now redirecting all their traffic to Hong Kong, where they have an uncensored site. So we'll see how this plays out. Well, another show is just about done, and we had a great time. Listen, go to stratford.edu to check out the programs. You can go to techtalkonline.com to sign up for the podcast. And we love your emails that you send to techtalk@stratford.edu.
If you like this show and like to hear it again, tune in tomorrow at 6 o'clock.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program. WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
We are indeed the home of Navy football, which you will hear later on today, beginning at 1:30, kickoff at 3:30, Navy travels to Troy, Alabama. For the forecast today, it's going to be a nice day, up in the 70-degree range. It's 10 o'clock.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers, as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those